content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a story from the Department of Science from the November 6, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Reinventing the Dinosaur, Life on Our Planet, a new Netflix nature documentary, renews our fascination with our most feared and loved precursors, by Rivka Galchen. Dan Tapster grew up watching David Attenborough's nature documentaries with his mother in a village outside London. "It was appointment viewing," he said. She still claims to be Attenborough's number one fan. A few years after graduating from university with a biology degree and following a stint leading nature tours in Peru, Tapster found himself working on Attenborough's films, first The Life of Mammals, and later, Planet Earth. Attenborough's documentaries are celebrated for their exceptional footage, often of little-known species or of rarely filmed behaviors. The codcod of Patagonia, the swarming of red-billed quailias over the African savanna, the dark-of-night hunts captured with infrared cameras of big cats. In a sense, viewers get to see what they cannot actually see. Once, Tapster and a colleague were filming pygmy marmosets, palm-sized monkeys with lion-like manes, in the rainforests of Ecuador when they were kidnapped by a group of Huarani women who thought they'd be a valuable bargaining tool in their conflict with the local government. Oh, it sounds so dramatic, but then the story gets less exciting because they were very nice and fed us and gave us a comfortable place to sleep, Tapster told me. Nonetheless, after a couple of days, the two men fled by canoe at night, paddling to a nearby town. But now they faced another problem. Until they could get transportation out, 2 days later, they had nothing to do. "I tried to read the one book I had as slowly as possible," Tapster said. Then he decided to flip a coin 1,000 times and record the outcomes, to see if it was in fact true that the coin would land on heads half the time. "Well, it was 499, he said, recalling that he was devastated that it wasn't 500. That level of devotion to verification has served him well in the making of Life on Our Planet, an 8-episode Netflix documentary for which Tapster, 47, is a writer and a showrunner. This drive to verify is essential because life on our planet spans 4 billion years and includes 65 extinct creatures. It is perhaps the most ambitious nature documentary ever made. Extraordinary footage of animals living today reveals, through persistent traits, the way the past is still present. Long-lost creatures are rendered with such accuracy and vividness that they have never seemed more alive. The extinct creatures, made using CGI, are placed in footage of contemporary landscapes. Paleobotanically, it's pretty accurate, Tom Fletcher, a paleontologist from Bristol, England, and the senior scientific researcher for the show, told me. In choosing sites to film, our biggest problem was grass, Fletcher said. Though grass has been around since the late Cretaceous period, it's only been widespread for about 25 million years. Ferns, conifers, those were sufficiently ancient. Fletcher was tasked with putting together a fact file for every extinct creature, one that detailed what is known about each species, inside and out, and its behavior, so that artists at Industrial Light and Magic, the visual effects company founded by George Lucas in 1975, could bring them to life. Some of the CGI dinosaur steps follow the precise pattern of documented trackways, also known as dinosaur footprints. Biomechanical studies offer persuasive estimates of bite force. Fossilized feces give evidence of ancient diets. And cross-sections of fossilized bone suggest how slowly or quickly an animal grew. From the assembled clues, the ILM artist imagined into being plateosauruses and woolly mammoths and theosodonts. Animals and plants alive today, especially those which in some way embody key moments in the story of life, the advent of flight, or of flowering, or of caring for one's young, are also seen in new ways. There's never before recorded footage of how nurse Megaponera ants take care of injured ants by applying a liquid from their bodies that contains antibiotics. This mixture of extinct and living creatures poses an aesthetic problem. The megaserops and gorgonopsids and 2-meter-long millipedes need to appear as realistic as present-day dragonflies, snow leopards, and hummingbirds. Visual effects can make Spider-Man and Iron Man appear to battle Thanos, but the challenge of accuracy shifts when the conjured creatures once really lived. Some of the vivid colors of species we know, flamingos, giraffes, wouldn't seem plausible in an extinct animal. Tapster said, "We tried slow-motion footage of an Allosaurus running at you to make it terrifying, a familiar move in footage of predators such as cheetahs, but it was more credible in real time." A trope in narrating the lives of artists is their art being so good that it can't be distinguished from nature. The 5th century BCE Greek painter Zeuxis is said to have painted grapes that were so realistic that birds came down to peck at them. A lamb painted by Titian was said to have prompted the bleeding of a mother ewe. After Titian completed his portrait of Pope Leo X, a cardinal supposedly tried to hand the figure a pen to sign a document. When watching life on our planet, I experienced that idea from the other side. The filmed footage of Komodo dragons hunting their own young appeared more fantastical to me than the CGI footage of Dunkleosteus, a predatory fish of the late Devonian period that was among the first to evolve a jaw, hunting an ammonite, an ancient hard-shelled little creature. Life on our planet does as much to reveal the extraordinary and alien nature of the animals we currently share the world with as it does to make familiar the extinct ones. These upside-down moments make extinction itself more vivid, more legible. Morgan Freeman, the series narrator, tells viewers early on that 99% of all species that have ever lived are now extinct, a fact whose contours are unfathomable. The story of life, one begins to realize, is also the story of 5 mass extinctions, and of the scrappy return of a fraction of the Earth's life forms following each one. Dreaming up a beast from fossil clues is not a new practice. You're out on a walk in 1600 or 600 or earlier. You come across an enormous skull with a large hole in front. What could it be? Some scholars hypothesize that the Cyclops' single eye, as described in the Odyssey, was inspired by the skull of a Deinotherium, a long-extinct creature with a trunk like an elephant that emerged from an opening in the front of its skull. In the 17th century, Robert Plot, a naturalist and the first keeper of the Ashmolean Museum at Oxford, described a fossil from Switzerland as appearing to be the thigh bone of a very large creature. Perhaps, he speculated, one of the elephants that Romans rode when they conquered Britannia. Almost 100 years later, Richard Brooks, an English physician, reconsidered Plot's detailed drawing of the fossil and gave it a scientific name that matched what he believed it was, Scrotum humanum, the scrotum of a giant human-like creature. Decades after that, William Buckland, a naturalist, looked at the fossil and other bones found in the area and concluded that they were more likely from a giant lizard, which he named Megalosaurus, a name that is still in use today. Such conjecture is only possible for the things that go fossilized at all, that left us evidence. You need to die in a shallow sea and be buried quickly if you want to have a good chance of being fossilized, Fletcher said. If we want to know more about the life that is no longer with us, fossils are the clues. That's why paleontology is the best. It's the ultimate cold case. In the Western world, until the 18th century, fossils were generally thought to belong to animals that still existed, just elsewhere. Thomas Jefferson, who was nicknamed Mr. Mammoth for his interest in fossils, instructed Lewis and Clark to keep an eye out for mastodons on their journey to the Pacific. This idea soon shifted, however. In 1808, the French anatomist Georges Cuvier was shown the fossilized remains of a 40-foot-long sea monster which had been found deep in a chalk quarry in Holland. He argued that it was a creature no longer living anywhere on Earth. Extinction was a wild idea for Europeans and Americans, the Great Flood notwithstanding. In the United States, the late 19th century bone wars gave paleontology the reputation of being a bit of a yahoo sport, with rich and richer men competing to acquire more fossils and name more creatures. Paleontology came to be seen as, well, a bit childish. Perhaps relatedly, dinosaurs were often seen as dim and lumbering reptiles. But we owe much of our understanding of not just extinct animals, but the history of the Earth to paleontology. Many paleontologists today date the dinosaur renaissance to John Ostrom of Yale, who in a 1963 paper argued that hadrosaurs ran quickly and upright, and whose subsequent finding of a Deinonychus, terrible claw, fossil in 1964 led him to assert that this large brained dinosaur had been agile, smart, and a pack hunter. Research by his student Robert Baker strengthened nascent ideas that dinosaurs had been plausibly warm-blooded and more like modern birds than like reptiles. Soon, the U.S. went from having around a dozen paleontologists to having thousands. In the past few decades, paleontology has arguably advanced as dramatically as biotech or cat memes. One large step forward came in the 1980s, when the geologist Walter Alvarez and his father, the physicist Luis Alvarez, put forth the idea that an asteroid strike had caused the death of the majority of non-avian dinosaurs. Even that now basic-seeming idea is younger than Laura Dern, who played a paleobotanist in Jurassic Park. A field that was once mostly men in hats going on digs in the Black Hills or Hell Creek is now one that combines geology, botany, chemistry, and biomechanical engineering. The slow-witted, yet still somehow terrifying dinosaurs of yesteryear are gone. And it's now not necessarily even dinosaurs that paleontologists study. There are so many other creatures, though the term dinosaur tends to be used by the public to mean most anything ancient, strange, or frightening. The shifting story of the Oviraptor captures something of the changes in paleontology. In 1923, an expedition to the Gobi Desert discovered dinosaur eggs, which were presumed to have belonged to Protoceratops, as there were many Protoceratops fossils nearby. A seemingly different species was found on top of a clutch of eggs and was named Oviraptor, the egg stealer. It appeared to be a fossilized crime scene. In 1993, scientists were again searching for fossils in the Gobi when they found a similar egg, This one with a preserved embryo inside, that of an oviraptor. The egg stealer was, in fact, a protective nesting parent. I went with my daughter to the American Museum of Natural History to see the titanosaur exhibit, which opened in 2016. The titanosaur is 122 feet long, and when it was first mounted at the museum, its discovery was so new that it hadn't yet been formally named. It was posed impishly, with part of its long neck and its head peeking beyond the entrance of the display hall. Museums are where most people first encounter a three-dimensional fossilized dinosaur skeleton, or a cast or a replica of one, and museum displays across the decades themselves become museum pieces, illustrating how the story of ancient history used to be told. In 1950, the American Museum of Natural History mounted specimen AMNH 5027, a ferocious-looking dinosaur. About 45% of its skeleton had been found, including a marvelously intact skull. The missing parts were constructed using educated guesses based on known relatives. A lot of dinosaurs, even today, are known from only one specimen, or two or three partial skeletons. Henry Fairfield Osborne, then the president of the museum, had named the specimen Tyrannosaurus rex, the tyrant lizard king. The Times, reporting on the fossil's discovery, wrote that it was more than 8 million years old. The Los Angeles Times said that the specimen was 3 million years old. It is estimated today to be 66 to 69 million years old. Osborne thought that the animal was pretty athletic, and he wanted to mount it in a dynamic way, showing two T-Rexes in a standoff over a fallen hadrosaur. But the pose was too much of an engineering challenge. It would have required numerous metal girders. Osborne then wanted the T-Rex to be as tall as possible, 20 feet high, but there was a beam in the way. Eventually, the T-Rex stood 18 feet high, posed in that classic tail-down, upright stance of our collective dinosaur imagination. It was the first dinosaur fossil display of its kind, and for many years, the only one. And it was seen by millions of people a year. The original mount had three claws on each of those curiously short front arms. When paleontologists concluded that the T-Rex had only two claws, one was plucked off each arm. In the early 1990s, more changes were made. The pose was altered. Its head and neck were lowered so that it now looks more like a magnificent giant running chicken. Today, the T-Rex stands only 12 feet above the ground at its highest point. By one estimate, a new extinct species is discovered nearly every week. In part out of nostalgia for elementary school trips to what was nicknamed the Dinosaur Museum, now the Sam Noble Museum of Natural History in Norman, Oklahoma, I called up a curator, Jacqueline Lungmus. She thought that she would become a veterinarian until she said, "I realize I didn't like soft tissue anatomy." She is part of the new generation of paleontologists. She received her PhD from the University of Chicago in 2020. She said that, in her eyes, a super bloom in paleontological knowledge occurred in the 90s with histology, the study of microscopic tissue. By cutting open bones and looking at them through a microscope, scientists could figure out how fast-growing a creature was, how long-living it was, she said. This revolutionized how we thought about their life histories. The rapid growth of dinosaurs suggested that they were warm-blooded, because cold-blooded reptiles necessarily grow more slowly. Though there is a long history of connecting birds to dinosaurs, the link only recently began to be seen as scientific fact by most experts and to make its way into the popular imagination. The paleontologist Gregory Erickson A professor at Florida State University tells the thousands of students in his course, Living with Dinosaurs, the Rise, Reign, and Demise of the Fearfully Great Reptiles, to recognize that they live in Jurassic Park with 11,000 species of dinosaurs, birds around them. Well, I think we looked at them as dead animals for a long time, but now see them as formerly living animals, Erickson said of dinosaurs. With that shift in perspective comes more interest in behavior. As an example, he spoke about how some dinosaurs are now understood to be most likely have been gregarious, a term that refers to living in social groups. Oh, we'll find cases where we have trackways of sometimes hundreds of skeletons that died at the same time, Erickson said. Reptiles are rarely gregarious. Birds almost always are. You don't see, like, 200 lizards crossing the street. Most of us have few ideas about what a Dunkelosteus or a Gorgonopsid or a terror bird might have looked like or of how they might have behaved. But paleontologists now have plenty. Early in the making of life on our planet, while thinking about how to depict animals whose appearances and behaviors would have to be deduced from an increasing but still mysterious set of fossil clues, the creators invited scientific consultants from Yale, Bristol University, and the University of London to the London office of ILM. We started with King Kong, in which a protagonist fights a T-Rex, and went on forward through to Jurassic Park to Walking with Dinosaurs, Tapscher said. The experts were asked to share what they thought about the different depictions of dinosaurs. I asked if the scientists liked any of them. Tapscher laughed. Mostly it was no, no, no. Even within the scientific community, there are often profound disagreements about how to interpret the fossil record. T-Rex, one of the dinosaurs about which the most is known, is a great example of this. Some scientists say that it moved like a roadrunner from hell, a moniker first used by Robert Baker. But others argue that T-Rex's legs would not have been able to bear the body's enormous weight while running. Some say T-Rex was mostly a hunter, and others assure you that it was really a scavenger. Some say that the king of the dinosaurs was covered with feathers, and others that only the young had feathers, or that among adults, probably only the males had a few decorative feathers. My generation, for the most part, can't picture T-Rex with any feathers at all. One thing I learned at that conference was the damned if you do, damned if you don't concept, Tapscher said. Among the few details that the scientists agreed on was that dinosaurs shouldn't look shrink-wrapped, Tapscher explained. Dinosaurs in films are often very muscly, as if they've just come from the gym. Except for human bodybuilders, animals don't look like that. Fletcher, the scientific consultant, said, we decided that T-Rexes needed to be hefty to have those chunky legs. How do you tell a story that spans 4 billion years? Estimating that there are 8 million or so species alive today and nearly 100 times more across time, and also the companion stories of the evolution of plants, and 8 episodes, each of them less than an hour, the math gets just silly. We had 2 geologists in the basement. I mean, they were really in the basement, giving us information about the planet's history, Tapscher said. Then the writers had to solve the challenge of making unfathomable scales of time and change feel intelligible. Well, at least a bit. We used post-it notes in 5 different colors, Tapscher said. I know, post-it notes. One color for prehistoric creatures with an important story to tell, learning to swim, or eggs that can survive out of water. Another color for prehistoric creatures that are iconic. Viewers need their dinosaurs. A third for modern-day animals in which exceptional evolutionary traits are apparent. A fourth for key events on Earth. And a fifth for potential cliffhanger moments. Then the team would discuss what would be included and what wouldn't make the cut. Tapscher said, one of our researchers, Ida Mae Jones, kept pushing for Lystrosaurus, a proto-mammal that she found very cute. We were like, ugh, it has to be more than just cute. The Lystrosaurus was herbivorous, about the size of a pig, with small tusks and a kind of a beak. Because its front legs are so much stronger than its back legs, it is believed to have dug and lived in burrows. It existed both before the Permian extinction, in relatively small numbers, and then also after it survived. She brought it up again, and she had really fallen for it, but what essential story was it telling? Tapscher said. Then Jones uncovered an unexpected detail about Lystrosaurus. At one point after the Permian extinction, the species represented 75% of all the vertebrates on Earth. It was briefly king. So, Lystrosaurus made it in, Tapscher said. A startled Lystrosaurus in its burrow appears early in episode 4. Tapscher and his writing team also wanted the show to highlight less well-known aspects of the history of life on Earth, creatures other than dinosaurs, the mesmerizing progression of plant life, momentous environmental events. I remember getting the note of, so you're beginning episode 2 with plankton and episode 3 with lichen, Tapscher said. But who knew, other than paleontologists, that there was a time in Earth's history when it rained for 1 million years? Or about the 40 million years when moss dominated the planet. Or about how plankton, by inventing photosynthesis and thereby giving off oxygen in the course of some 2 billion years, transformed Earth's yellow methane-filled atmosphere into blue skies and the lifeless landscape into forest of green. In William Steig's book, Rotten Island, illustrations show erupting volcanoes and creepy sea creatures and thorny plants and vicious land animals. One day, a jealous battle starts over a new life form, a flower. Violence, destruction, giant insects and ice and fire ensue and lead to a mass extinction. I used to think that Rotten Island was about the disastrous pettiness of human wants and behaviors, and about how much better life might be without us. Now, I see it as a reasonably accurate visual history of our planet, with extra polka dots and stripes in watercolor. Even if you haven't visited it in person, there's a good chance you've seen Cheatham Grove, an ecological park in Northern California. It's where the famous chase scene in Return of the Jedi was filmed. Walking a few minutes with Tapscher and Fletcher along a trail strewn with redwood needles and sheltered by trees several hundred feet tall, I met Jonathan Privet, the visual effects supervisor from Industrial Light and Magic. Jolyon Sutcliffe, a producer and a director with an extensive background in natural history documentaries, and Katie Frazier, a camera operator whose additional skills as a deep sea diver were essential for many of life on our planet's underwater scenes. They were snacking on grapes and chatting while waiting for the sun to come out from behind the clouds so that they could shoot footage that would match that of previous days. Nature documentary is often hours and hours of waiting and then a few moments of intensity, Sutcliffe told me. He had stayed up for many nights in the Sonoran Desert to capture the moment when a kangaroo rat leaps out to karate kick an attacking rattlesnake in midair. He had sat for hours waiting for the tiny scuffle of dust that signifies a trapdoor spider popping out from its burrow to seize its prey. During the pandemic, he spent weeks filming lichen growing. thousands of those images had to be stacked for the sequence in Life on Our Planet that shows lichen spreading across the land. The team had their equipment on hand, including a special 360-degree camera that is essential for making the lighting of the landscape convincingly correspond to the lighting on the extinct creatures. In this case, an Anchiornis, a small gliding dinosaur speeding among the trees. Although natural history people tend to be reactive when it comes to lighting and other details, Fraser explained. The visual effects people have to be methodical. Privet is 54, with a friendly, relaxed, slightly mischievous vibe. He showed me on a laptop the method he and other ILM artists used to build a creature. It's like making a real puppet, he said. He pulled up files on Anchiornis. We first build the skeleton. The audience never sees the skeleton, but if you get that right, a lot follows. The skeleton could be animated, and see, we realized the wings couldn't fold completely away like a pigeon's. So Anchiornis, with his wings only partially tucked in, looks a bit like he's wearing a cape. And then we add the muscles, and then the skin, and it's like a sculpture. Some remarkably intact Anchiornis specimens have been found, so there's a lot of information to work with. And then we add the feathers. In recent years, scientists have even deduced the color of the species' feathers by a microscopic examination of melanosomes, a kind of pigment cell. Parameters can be put in for how stiff the various feathers are and for how many barbs they have. It's the same with fur. You can decide how clumpy it is, he added. Wind and turbulence variables can be added, too, Privet went on. He doesn't fly so much. It's more like what Buzz Lightyear says. He falls with style. He's sort of a part bird, part flying squirrel. Privet's background is in mechanical engineering. After graduating from college in 1991, he took a job in Detroit modeling cars with software that was new at the time. The software allowed car designers to work digitally instead of having to build a model by hand. Soon, Privet was offered a position at a visual effects company, and he has spent more than 20 years doing work he would never have foreseen, and that he loves. Well, this is kind of embarrassing, but I was never a fiction person. I read the dictionary and the encyclopedia, he told me. The scientific information that went into building creatures naturally appealed to him, even though it's a leap of faith, too, he said. Fur and feathers are the toughest. The snow blowing through the woolly mammoth's fur, that was a lot of work, he said with a little shudder. Tom Fletcher's PhD was on the hydrodynamics of ancient fish and sharks. And he lights up when talking about geologic formations, fossilized skin impressions, the movement patterns of early amphibians. In becoming a paleontologist, Fletcher, who's 36, didn't so much follow his dreams as follow his fears. The room of dioramas at dinosaurs in the Natural History Museum in Liverpool? They're outdated now, but it looked like a sinister aquarium with ichthyosaurs and giant squids, and I would have nightmares about them, he said. They were terrifying, but also awesome. His parents sometimes drove him to the coast where he searched for fossils, deciding pretty early on that that was what he wanted to do with his life. One of Fletcher's jobs in Life on Our Planet was to give feedback on each draft of extinct creatures. Once ILM artists had visuals, they would send a collection of images, almost always including one of the creatures posed next to a fountain topped with a statue of Yoda, which sits in front of ILM's San Francisco offices. Revisions would then be suggested to improve on both the feel of what Tapster and others thought would work best artistically, and, for Fletcher, the scientific accuracy. A producer might want to put something characterful on a creature, such as a crest, and Fletcher would have to explain that owing to fossil evidence, it wasn't possible. Pretty much all the accuracy changes suggested we were into, but there was disappointment about having to put lips on the Tyrannosaurus rex, Tapster said. Lips are likely rare on the T-Rexes of the popular imagination. But the science was pretty strong, Fletcher said. With T-Rex's feathers, there was disagreement among experts about how many there would have been. An early draft of the T-Rex looked like he had a mullet and was headed to a Metallica concert, Tapster said. We asked them to pluck some of the feathers. More often, Tapster said, ILM saved the show from mistaking an inexact science for an exact one, from failing to take advantage of the special insights of art. He gave the example of the terror bird, a 10-foot-tall apex predator that lived after the dinosaurs. In life on our planet, we see one terror bird in a territorial dispute and another as it hunts a group of cute llama-like creatures. There is limited fossil evidence of the terror bird, so in designing one, the production team tried to Frankenstein it from modern-day descendants. We said to ILM, give it the legs of a secretary bird and the beak of its closest living relative, a sarema, a much smaller leggy bird that often sports a bright beak with a fanciful plume at its base. What resulted looked like a giant chicken with lipstick, Tapster said. They asked the artist to come up with a version that looked like it belonged in the sandy landscape and was suitably terrifying, as per the ambush predator's name. They came up with something so much better, Tapster said. The terror bird now looks more like an ostrich on steroids, but with a killer hooked beak. So many astounding creatures now gone. One theme across the episodes is that of the dominant species not surviving the next extinction. It tends to be the smaller, more adaptable ones that make it to the far side. Another through line is that of chance. Not only how a random mutation can end up being useful to a creature's survival, but also, for example, the chance arrival of the dinosaur-killing asteroid. On our drive back to San Francisco from Cheatham Grove, Tapster said, that meteorite is thought to have been stuck in the asteroid belt before maybe a collision kicked it out onto its 35-million-year trajectory to crash into the Earth. The precise place where the asteroid hit exacerbated the calamity. It landed in an area full of gypsum, which vaporizes into sulfur, which in turn blocks sunlight. If that journey had ended 2 hours earlier or 2 hours later, so that its impact was elsewhere, that would have made a difference. Italo Calvino's short story, The Dinosaurs, from 1965, is narrated by a dinosaur that has survived the extinction. Feeling himself to be the last of his kind, he's lonely. He joins a community of new ones who don't recognize him as a dinosaur or really know anything about dinosaurs, but who tell frightening stories about them. The new ones fear changes to over-the-top admiration, then eventually to telling stories of dinosaurs that position them as laughable, as terrible monsters playing ridiculous roles. They use stories of dinosaurs unknowingly for their own shifting emotional and psychological ends. Late in the story, after a dinosaur fossil is found by the new ones, the dinosaur sees everything we had been and were no longer, our majesty, our faults, our ruin. When the new ones move on to the new idea of dinosaurs as bound to the idea of a sad end, he gets fed up and leaves. Calvino's story, written when the extinction of the dinosaurs was still a mystery, now reads as a parable about our own possible extinction, even as its causes are not cloaked but visible. We are the new ones now, telling a shifting set of stories, often heedless of their accuracy. The dramatizations of the extinctions in life on our planet were difficult to watch, though they were, in a way, magnificent. As sea life froze or suffocated, or the land transformed into an oven, I admit that I often turned away, as it looked all too real. And now, from the annals of a warming planet department of the November 6, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine, can seawalls save us? Huge coastal barriers could protect the world's cities, but they'll have unexpected costs. By Daniel A. Gross. Pacifica, California, just south of San Francisco, is the kind of beachfront community that longtime residents compare to heaven. One of its streets is called Paradise Drive. Local fishermen brag that Pacifica Pier is among the state's best places to catch salmon, striped bass, and crab. Every few years, a superbloom blankets the coast with golden wildflowers. When the sun cuts through the region's famous fog, the sky sometimes glows, as in a Turner painting. Some of Pacifica's most dramatic views could be found on Esplanade Drive, where mid-century developers built bungalows on top of a cliff. For almost 50 years, residents gazed out from their backyards to see whales splashing in the Pacific. Then, in 1998, a group of homeowners gathered to say goodbye. "I cannot express how spectacular it has been living here," one of them, Joe Parker, said at the time. "I've seen dolphins out there. I recognize all the seabirds." Beverly Axelrod, who spent 14 years on Esplanade Drive, recalled how her ocean view had healed everything. But then a series of vicious storms, fueled in part by the warm waters of El Nino, had washed away more than 30 feet of the cliff beneath their homes. Workers had to saw Axelrod's house in half to prevent it from falling into the sea. Ken LaJoy, a local geologist, said that even after the wind and waves abated, more of the cliff would crumble. The city ultimately condemned 7 houses to be bulldozed. One woman was now paying the mortgage on a house that didn't even exist anymore. Axelrod compared the demolition to being at the bedside of somebody who's dying. In the 1980s, Pacifica had fortified parts of its shore with a 20-foot wall concrete seawall. It had also coated some areas with loose rock known as riprap. After the storms of 1998, the city shored up its defenses again. State and federal agency gave Pacifica $1.5 million to pile riprap at the base of the cliff. The city thought of its investments as forward-thinking in light of climate change. But LaJoy warned that riprap seawalls usually fail. "Stop building structures along eroding coastlines," he told a San Francisco Chronicle reporter in 2001. "Prevent future construction of seawalls of any type." LaJoy was right. The seawall beneath Esplanade Drive did not stop the sea. In 2010, part of the cliff fell out from under an apartment building, which had to be abandoned and then torn down. By 2018, only one house remained on a portion of the street that overlooked the cliff. After its patio tumbled off the edge, the city government bought the house and demolished it. Around that time, the mayor of Pacifica, John Keener, started talking about adapting to rising seas, and even about managed retreat. Instead of trying to fortify the shore forever, he suggested, residents might consider moving out of harm's way. Most people, understandably, don't want to abandon their homes. In a new book, California Against the Sea, Visions for Our Vanishing Coastline, published by Heyday, Rosanna Zia, an environmental reporter at the Los Angeles Times, visits Pacifica and encounters a sign that reads, "No managed retreat." At a city council meeting, a father of three stands up and declares, "It's war with the sea. We may win, we may lose, but we should never give up the ground unnecessarily." Keener was voted out of office, in large part by residents calling for stronger coastal protections. The city fell asleep and should have seawalled all this decades earlier, one man told Zia. Pacifica embodies one of the central disagreements about rising seas. Fight or flight, stay or go. Flight can seem unimaginable, but if we try to fight the ocean with rock and concrete, it will cost us, and it may not work. Pacifica currently plans to borrow tens of millions of dollars to reinforce its seawall. Writing for a community blog, Greg Digas, a critic of this plan, objected not just to its price, but to the moral hazard it would create. By forestalling erosion, the seawall might only encourage more people to live in risky places. Once sea level rise gets here, it's never going away, at least not for thousands of years, Digas wrote. Meanwhile, he noted, only 1% of the homes in Pacifica were at risk. You will have to decide, as a group, whether paying to hold back the tides is a good use of your precious money, he concluded. It's a question many more of us will soon be asking. When do seawalls make sense? And when is it better to give in to the tides? The oldest known seawall was built around 5000 BC after a period of warming that melted glaciers and lifted the Mediterranean by a staggering 26 feet. A Stone Age community living near a beach in present-day Israel tried to ward off the sea with a wall of 3-foot-tall boulders about the length of a football field. But in the millennia that followed, the Mediterranean rose even more. Archaeologists ultimately discovered the stones on the seafloor under 10 feet of water. The site, they wrote, was ominously relevant to our time. Other excavations have turned up ancient coastal fortifications in places like Lebanon and Egypt. Ancient Roman ports used a kind of concrete that grew stronger in contact with water. In the war with the sea, the Dutch have probably spent the longest in the trenches. When Pliny the Elder visited the Low Countries in 47 AD, he compared the people he met to maroon sailors living on artificial mounds of mud. By the early Middle Ages, locals started to build a seawall. A 1948 book by a Dutch engineer, Dredge, Drain, Reclaim, The Art of a Nation, describes the wall as a major victory in an existential struggle. Formerly, the terrible evils of the sea, the storm floods, and the more terrible marine erosion had to be endured. But now the fight began to throw the sea out of the country, a fight not yet ended, and a fight for to be or not to be, he wrote. But the walls had a side effect. They locked the land into place, trading in a dynamic shoreline for one that could not adapt as easily and that would need to be defended forever. There are many kinds of coastal protection. Some of the most effective are entirely natural. Marshes, mangroves, and even sandy beaches can absorb the destructive power of waves, helping to soak up water and energy that would otherwise wreak havoc. Engineers can fortify a shoreline by replenishing lost sand or by adding rock, wood, or concrete. It's also possible to augment the shore. A rock pile that parallels the coast, shielding the beach from waves, is called a breakwater. A pile that juts out to the sea, trapping sand on one side, is called a groin. All of these measures are already widely used on coastlines around the world. Hard seawalls may be the bluntest instrument in coastal engineering. Typically, they are made from concrete, stone, wood, or metal, and rise vertically from the shore. But a wave that strikes a seawall never breaks and dissipates, as it would on a beach. Instead, it bounces off like an echo, its destructive force intact. In the end, the flow of water and sediment is a zero-sum game. For a wave to spare one place, it has to strike another. For sand to accumulate somewhere, it has to wash away from somewhere else. According to the sociologist Summer Gray, seawalls are less a practical solution than a product of technocratic ideology, one that colonial powers have exported around the world. For all their potential benefits, seawalls harm the environment, shift vulnerability downstream, lead to the disappearance of the beach, and create cycles of dependency. She writes in her new book, In the Shadow of the Seawall, published by University of California Press. In one meticulous chapter, Gray recounts how the Dutch West India Company settled the low-lying coast of Guyana in South America. Planters enslaved Africans who were forced to build seawalls and then to cultivate sugarcane. The people of Guyana eventually came to see that their aging seawalls as a necessity. There was now significant development on low-lying land. When storms surge over our protections, we tend to wonder why they weren't higher, rather than questioning the logic of living by the sea. In the 19th century, Gray writes, engineers started to consider the unintended consequences of fortifications. In 1899, Edward Case, the keeper of the Dymchurch Wall, which protects Romney Marsh in southern England, noted that when the lords of the marsh built their manors in the muck, they locked themselves into centuries of dependence on the wall. But for the value of the land at stake, the struggle must have been abandoned, Case observed. After waves washed away sediment in front of the wall, he made a counterintuitive argument. Seawalls can contribute to the erosion they are supposed to prevent. At the base of a seawall, the constant churn of water stirs up sediment. That sediment is then swept back to sea. This phenomenon is now known as scour. Sometimes the water erodes so much sand that it causes walls to collapse. Over the seawall, tsunamis, cyclones, drought, and the delusion of controlling nature, published by Island Press, by the journalist Stephen Robert Miller, tells a story of the double-edge engineering in Bangladesh, where the flow of water and sediment creates a rich and ever-changing agricultural zone. The region is not so much a world pestered by water as one defined by it, Miller writes. But when the British colonized Bangladesh, they fractured the waterscape with embankments, farms, and railroads. After they departed, international development workers went a step further, walling off 103 low-lying islands that they called polders, using a Dutch word for the land that is reclaimed and then fortified. Although these walls protect lives and property, they also draw Bangladeshis to areas that are vulnerable to storm surges, which devastate coastal communities during tropical cyclones. Miller writes of some floods that paradoxically killed more people in the places with stronger walls. The embankments provide only pseudo-security, Dilip Datta, an environmental scientist at Kulnaut University, tells him. They work against our best interest. When I ran these critiques of coastal protection by Rachel Gitman, a marine ecologist at East Carolina University, she offered another reason to worry about seawalls. Natural habitats already serve as powerful buffers against flooding, she said. They absorb water and energy. This is why marsh and mangrove restoration is often the best way to protect a coast. By contrast, when coastal communities wall off the shoreline, they tend to trap ecosystems between the water and the wall, causing a process called coastal squeeze. It can be a slow drowning of those habitats, she told me. When they disappear, we may be more vulnerable than when we started. Our present dilemma is worse than it needed to be. In 1981, a group of coastal geologists gathered on Skidaway Island in Georgia to write a report called Saving the American Beach. They warned that rising seas and migration toward the ocean would expose a growing number of people to erosion, flooding, and storms. Saving the shore, they argued, might, quote, involve drastic and unpopular measures, such as assuming that buildings adjacent to the beach are temporary or expendable, end quote. By the time a second group of experts met at Skidaway in 1985, their fears had escalated. They wrote, "Sea level is rising and the American shoreline is retreating. We face economic and environmental realities that leave us two choices. One, plan for a strategic retreat now, or two, undertake a vastly expensive program of armoring the coastline and, as required, retreating through a series of unpredictable disasters," end quote. The Skidaway experts were hardly the only ones to foresee our current circumstances. Yet, in the decades since their reports, the number of Americans who live near a coast has almost doubled. In 2018, coastal counties were home to 128 million people, or 40% of U.S. residents. Today, about 14% of the coast is fortified with hard barriers. Coastal protection is usually treated as a cost and benefit problem. The more people and property in a given place, the greater a seawall's benefits. Last year, when the Army Corps of Engineers proposed a vast network of seawalls and gates to shield New York and New Jersey Harbor, it argued that the $53 billion project was a very good deal, although it, quote, will not totally eliminate flood risks in the area. It would cost much less than repairing the city after a storm. Hurricane Sandy caused an estimated $19 billion in damage in New York City alone. On a windy evening in August, I biked to a park in Lower Manhattan to meet Yuki Miura, a soft-spoken researcher who has modeled the flooding that a hurricane would inflict on Manhattan. As the sun set, Miura and I looked out across the water on the East River. The clouds were turning purple and orange. A few boats drifted by. It was easy to understand why someone would want to live there. Then I asked Miura what would happen to the Queens waterfront, where no comparable seawalls have been built. I asked Maria what would happen there. Could the water that would have flooded Manhattan instead end up somewhere else like Queens? It will be shifted, yeah, Maria told me. Water has to go somewhere. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.